A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it hits where a lot of us live. He's asking about money shame. That specific, almost physical discomfort some people feel when it's time to charge for their work, negotiate a salary, or even just send an invoice. The question is, why do some people have zero compunction about naming their price, while others would rather do the work for free than have the conversation? And what's actually happening psychologically when we inherit these attitudes from parents or culture, then watch them play out in our bank accounts?
The moment you realize you'd rather do free work than send an invoice, that's not laziness, that's a psychological inheritance. And it's everywhere once you start looking.
I've seen people spend 3 hours on a proposal and then choke on the line where they have to type a number. Just stare at the cursor, as if the cursor is judging them.
The cursor is judging them. That's the thing. The brain treats that moment as a social threat. There's foundational research on this from Eisenberger and colleagues back in 2003, published in Science. They found that social rejection activates the same neural pathways as physical pain. The anterior cingulate cortex lights up in both cases. So when someone anticipates being seen as greedy or demanding or difficult, their brain is literally bracing for pain. It's not metaphor, it's neurology.
Sending an invoice is neurologically adjacent to being punched.
In anticipation, yes. The brain doesn't distinguish well between they might think I'm greedy and they might hit me. Same alarm system.
Which explains why people will do elaborate mental gymnastics to avoid it. Oh, I'll just send it next week. Maybe I should discount this one since the project was kind of fun. They're a small business. I don't want to burden them. Meanwhile, the client is a Fortune 500 company with a procurement department that processes invoices in batches of thousands.
That's the thing. The shame isn't responding to reality. It's responding to a script. And this matters now more than ever. By the end of 2025, 36% of the U.S. workforce was participating in the gig economy as either primary or secondary income, according to the Freelancers Union and Upwork annual report. At the same time, salary transparency laws have spread to 15 states as of this month, per SHRM tracking. The ability to name your price without shame isn't optional anymore. It's a survival skill.
Let's define what we're actually talking about. Money shame isn't financial anxiety. Financial anxiety is, can I pay my rent? Money shame is, do I deserve to be paid for this at all?
It's specifically about the discomfort of receiving, not managing. You can be perfectly competent at budgeting, tracking expenses, investing, and still feel vaguely nauseous when you have to tell someone your rate. And it exists on a spectrum. On one end, you've got the freelancer who's been charging $50 an hour for 3 years while knowing the market rate is $125. On the other end, you've got the executive who feels entitled to a $2 million bonus and doesn't blink. Same underlying mechanism, different outputs.
Different outputs is right. One person undercharges by 40%. Another overcharges by 100% and sleeps like a baby. What's the common mechanism?
Both are responding to stories about who deserves money and what money means. The freelancer has internalized, people like me don't charge that much. The executive has internalized, people like me deserve this. Neither is responding to market signals. Both are responding to identity scripts.
The freelancer's script is easier to spot as self-defeating. The executive script often gets mistaken for confidence.
Right, and we'll get to that. But first, let's trace where these scripts come from, because you can't reprogram something you don't recognize as programming.
Where do they come from?
Three primary channels. First, parental modeling. This is the most direct inheritance. Some people grew up hearing, money doesn't grow on trees, as a constant refrain, a scarcity mantra that teaches anxiety around any financial ask. Others grew up with parents who openly discussed wealth building, investments, negotiation. Neither set of parents was necessarily right or wrong, but the child absorbed a whole posture toward money before they were old enough to question it.
My favorite is the misattributed scripture, money is the root of all evil.
That's the second channel, religious and cultural scripts. The actual verse is, the love of money is the root of all evil. Very different thing. But the shortened version has done enormous damage. It teaches that having money, or even asking for it, is morally suspect. Then on the opposite end, you've got prosperity gospel traditions that treat wealth as a sign of divine favor. Both are scripts, not economic analysis.
The third channel?
Class-based shame. This is the know-your-place messaging that gets transmitted in upward mobility narratives. If you grew up working class and then entered a professional field, there's often this internal voice that says charging premium rates is getting above yourself. It's a loyalty check. Are you still one of us, or have you sold out?
That one's insidious, because it masquerades as integrity. I don't want to forget where I came from. But forgetting where you came from and charging market rate are not the same thing. You can remember your roots and also pay your mortgage.
The mechanism that makes all of this stick is cognitive dissonance. Most people have a self-concept as a good person, generous, fair, not greedy. Then they have to perform an action that their brain codes as taking. The brain has to resolve the conflict somehow, and it does it by devaluing either the work or the self.
I'm not really worth that much. It's less painful than I'm a bad person for asking.
And there's a concept researchers call the worthiness gap. There was a 2024 study in the Journal of Behavioral Economics that quantified this. People with high money shame systematically undervalue their labor by 18 to 32% compared to objective market benchmarks, even when they know what the benchmarks are.
Wait? Even when they know? So this isn't an information problem.
It is absolutely not an information problem. You can show someone the salary survey, the rate card, the industry data. They'll nod and say, I know, and then they'll quote 30% below it anyway. Because the problem isn't in the spreadsheet. It's in the anterior cingulate cortex bracing for social pain.
Knowledge doesn't fix it. You can't spreadsheet your way out of shame.
You cannot spreadsheet your way out of shame. That's maybe the single most important thing to understand about this. How many times have you seen someone think, if I just find the right market data, then I'll feel confident charging that rate? It never works. Because the shame isn't responding to data, it's responding to a threat detection system that evolved to keep us in the tribe. Charging money feels like risking expulsion. The brain will trade 30% of lifetime income to avoid that risk.
Let's put a number on that. What's the actual cost of this over a career?
There was a 2025 meta-analysis on salary negotiation that looked at lifetime earnings trajectories. The difference between someone who negotiates consistently and someone who avoids it is between $500,000 and $1.2 million over a career. That's not hypothetical. That's the compounding effect of starting lower and getting percentage raises on a lower base.
$500,000 to over $1 million. The price of avoiding awkward conversations.
It's not just salary. Think about the freelance graphic designer case. $50 an hour for 3 years while the market rate was $125. If she's billing 1,500 hours a year, that's over $100,000 a year she's leaving on the table. Her client was a Fortune 500 company with a budget line for creative services. They weren't suffering.
What did she say when someone asked why?
I don't want to seem greedy. That's the script talking. Greed is charging more than the value you deliver. Shame is charging less. She was delivering $125 an hour of value and accepting $50. That's not humility. That's a trauma response wearing a humility costume.
A trauma response wearing a humility costume. That's the whole episode right there.
Here's the thing. The client probably never thought about it twice. They got good work at a bargain rate and moved on. The shame was entirely internal. The client wasn't judging her. She was judging herself and projecting it onto the client.
We've traced where the shame comes from. Now let's look at the opposite end. The people who have no compunction at all, or who actively overcharge. What's happening there?
This is where it gets interesting, because the surface read is, they're confident. But a lot of what looks like confidence is actually a compensatory mechanism for the same underlying shame, just externalized as grandiosity. It's what psychologists call a narcissistic defense against worthlessness.
The person demanding a $2 million bonus isn't necessarily free of money shame. They might be running from it harder.
If deep down you believe you're worthless, one way to manage that is to demand constant external validation in the form of money. The number becomes proof that the shame voice is wrong. But it never is enough, because the shame isn't actually about money, it's about worth, so no amount of money resolves it. You just keep needing more.
That's the tragedy of it. The person who undercharges and the person who overcharges are both letting shame drive the car. One's just flooring it in reverse.
Both are disconnected from market reality. The healthy position is neither undercharging nor overcharging. It's charging what the market says the work is worth, with awareness and intention. That sounds simple, and it's incredibly hard for people with money shame.
Because what the market says requires you to make an ask.
The ask is the whole problem. There's a cognitive bias called anchoring that makes this worse. In a negotiation, the first number mentioned tends to pull the final number toward it. That's the anchor. People without money shame anchor to the market. They say, the range for this role is 120 to 150. I'm looking for 140. People with money shame anchor to their own internal number. I'd be happy with 60. And then they adjust downward from there.
Wait, downward from their own low anchor?
The pattern is, they start below market. Then they worry that even that number is too high, so they mentally revise it lower before they even open their mouth. By the time they speak, they've anchored to something like 40% below market. And the employer, who was prepared to pay market, just got a bargain.
The employer's not the villain here. The shame is.
And the data bears this out. According to Salary.com's 2025 data, only 2.3% of job offers are rescinded after negotiation. That's it. Meanwhile, 84% of employers expect negotiation. They build room into the offer specifically because they expect you to ask. The person who doesn't ask isn't being polite. They're leaving money on a table that was set for them.
2.3%. So the fear of the offer being pulled is almost entirely unfounded.
And the cases where offers do get rescinded tend to involve extreme demands or unprofessional behavior, not reasonable negotiation. The thing people are afraid of basically doesn't happen.
Yet the fear feels completely real. That's the Eisenberger finding in action. The brain doesn't care about base rates, it cares about threat.
Which brings us to the practical question, how do you actually rewire this? Because understanding the mechanism intellectually doesn't fix it. We just established that.
Knowing you have a broken leg doesn't set the bone.
Let's talk about what does work. There are two approaches that have actual research behind them, and they work best together. The first is reframing. The second is exposure.
Start with reframing. What's the frame shift?
The core reframe is what researchers call the service frame. Instead of thinking of charging as taking, you think of it as enabling. When you charge fairly, you create the conditions to serve more people sustainably. You can't serve anyone if you're burned out and resentful because you're undercharging. You can't serve anyone if you can't pay your own bills. Charging market rate isn't selfish. It's what allows you to keep showing up at full capacity.
The reframe is, my rate isn't about what I take from you. It's about what I need to sustain the quality of what I give you.
And there's a 2025 study from Harvard Business Review that tested this directly. Professionals who framed their fees as enabling service negotiated 22% higher rates than those who framed them as compensation for time. Same skills, same market, same clients. The frame changed the outcome.
22% just from how you describe it to yourself before you even say a number.
Because the frame quiets the shame alarm. I'm enabling service doesn't trigger the same social threat response as I'm asking for money. The brain hears it differently.
It's not a semantic trick. It's actually true. If you undercharge to the point where you can't sustain the work, you're going to disappear from that client's life eventually. Charging sustainably is a form of reliability.
Clients know this. Good clients, anyway. They want you to be solvent. They want you to be available next year. They don't want to feel like they're exploiting you. That's uncomfortable for them, too.
The service frame isn't spin. It's just making explicit what's already true but unspoken.
Now the second approach is exposure therapy, systematic desensitization to asking. This comes out of a 2024 clinical trial that used an 8-week protocol of graduated ask practice. The results were striking. Scores on the validated financial shame scale dropped by 41% after 8 weeks.
41% in 2 months. What did the protocol actually involve?
It's beautifully simple. You start with extremely low stakes, asks where the outcome doesn't matter. Asking for a discount at a store, asking for a free coffee refill, asking for something small that you're fairly sure you'll get. The point isn't the discount or the coffee. The point is teaching your nervous system that asking doesn't kill you.
You're retraining the anterior cingulate cortex through repetition.
You're building evidence that the social threat your brain anticipates doesn't materialize. Week by week, you escalate. By the end, you're negotiating salary or raising your rates. But you've built a foundation of lived experience that says, I can ask and survive.
There's a case study in the research on this, right? The software engineer?
Software engineer spent 6 months doing ask practice. Started with asking for a free coffee refill, literally the smallest possible ask. Ended with negotiating a $45,000 raise. The key insight he reported was separating the ask from the outcome. The win wasn't getting the raise. The win was making the ask without shame. The raise was almost incidental.
That's the mind bend. The goal isn't the money. The goal is the freedom to ask.
Once you have that freedom, the money tends to follow. Because you're no longer anchoring to your internal shame number, you're anchoring to the market. You're no longer adjusting downward from already low. You're just...
Let's talk about the specific language difference. You mentioned earlier the contrast between, I'm looking for 120K, and I'd be grateful for anything you think is fair.
That contrast is everything. The first candidate is market anchored. They've done their research, they know the range, and they're stating a number within it. The second candidate is shame anchored. They're essentially saying, please don't reject me, I'll take whatever you give me. And the data shows the first candidate gets offers averaging 18% higher.
For saying a number instead of an apology.
Here's the thing. The shame-anchored candidate thinks they're being polite. They think they're being easy to work with. What they're actually being is a bargain. And employers, even good ones, will take the bargain. Not out of malice. Just because it was offered.
I'd be grateful for anything. Is not a negotiation strategy. It's a surrender.
It's a surrender wrapped in the language of humility. And that's one of the big misconceptions we should name directly. People think, I'm just being humble. But humility is a choice. Underselling yourself is a compulsion. One is a virtue. The other is a trauma response. They feel similar because both involve lowering yourself, but the motivation is completely different.
That's a crucial distinction. Humility is, I know my worth, and I choose not to flaunt it. Underselling is, I don't believe I have worth, so I'll preemptively discount myself before anyone else can.
The second misconception is about greed. People think charging market rate is greedy, but greed is charging more than the value you deliver. Shame is charging less. Alignment is charging the market rate for the value you deliver. Those are three different things, and we collapse them into two, not greedy and greedy, and call anything above our shame. Anchor greedy.
The person charging $50 an hour for a $125 service isn't being virtuous. They're being misaligned.
Misalignment hurts everyone. It hurts the undercharger, obviously, but it also distorts the market for other providers, and it creates weird dynamics with clients who sense they're getting a deal but don't know why.
Let's get concrete about what someone can actually do with this. If a listener is recognizing themselves in this conversation, what do they do tomorrow morning?
Three things, and they build on each other. First, identify your inheritance. Write down three explicit messages about money you received before age 18. Not general impressions, specific phrases. Money doesn't grow on trees. We don't talk about money in this family. Rich people are greedy. Whatever they are, write them down. Then ask two questions. Whose voice is this, and is this voice helping me or hurting me in 2026?
That second question is the key. The voice might have been protective in its original context. It might have made sense for your parents' circumstances. But you're not living in their circumstances.
A scarcity message that made sense for Depression-era grandparents might be actively harmful for a software engineer in a tight labor market. The message isn't wrong, it's just not yours.
What's the second action?
Separate worth from transaction. Your value as a human is infinite. Your hourly rate is a market signal. They are not the same number. Practice saying this out loud, my rate is X dollars. This is not a statement about my worth. It's a statement about the market. Say it until you can say it without flinching.
That's harder than it sounds. Saying your rate without apologizing with your tone.
Because the shame lives in the body, not the intellect. You can understand the distinction perfectly and still feel your throat tighten when you say the number. That's why you practice.
The third action?
Use the service frame in your next negotiation. instead of, I deserve this because I worked hard, which is an appeal to worth and therefore triggers the worth shame loop. Say this rate allows me to bring my full capacity to this work without resentment. That's a statement about sustainability, not worth. It's harder to argue with, and it doesn't trigger your own shame alarm.
Without resentment is doing a lot of work there. It's implicitly saying, if I charge less, I will resent this arrangement, and that resentment will degrade the work.
Which is true. And clients, good ones, understand that implicitly. They don't want a resentful provider any more than you want to be one.
None of this is manipulation. It's just accurate communication that the shame was preventing.
That's the whole thing. Money shame doesn't make you more ethical. It makes you less accurate. It distorts your communication, your pricing, your relationship to your own work. Overcoming it isn't about becoming greedier. It's about becoming clearer.
There's a forward-looking dimension here, too. The prompt mentions AI commoditizing skills. What's the connection?
As AI gets better at producing outputs, code, designs, analysis, text, the thing that becomes harder to commoditize is uniquely human judgment. The ability to sit with a client and understand what they actually need, not just what they ask for. That's what people will pay for. And if you can't charge for it without shame, you're surrendering the one durable differentiator you have.
Money shame isn't just a personal problem. It's a strategic vulnerability.
In an economy where more and more outputs are automatable, the ability to name your price for the human element becomes the whole game. Money shame is a luxury we can no longer afford.
Before we move to takeaways, I want to name something that often gets missed in these conversations. There's a gender dimension here that's well documented, but there's also a personality dimension that cuts across gender. Some of the most money shame people I know are men who were raised with very strong provider scripts and then ended up in creative or caring professions where those scripts conflict.
The provider script says you must earn a lot to be worthy. The creative script says charging for art is selling out. Put those together and you've got someone who feels like a failure whether they charge market rate or not. It's a double bind.
The double bind is the shame engine. You can't win, so you freeze.
Freeze is exactly right, and freezing looks like never raising your rates for years, or never applying for a higher level role, or always having a reason why now isn't the right time to negotiate.
I'll do it next quarter, for 12 consecutive quarters.
The freeze response is the body's way of saying, both options feel like death, so I'll choose neither. And the way out isn't to argue with the freeze. It's to make the ask small enough that the freeze doesn't activate, hence the coffee refill.
The exposure therapy protocol is basically tricking your nervous system into learning that asking is safe by starting with asks so small the alarm doesn't trip.
You're not fighting the shame. You're sneaking past it.
All right. Let's crystallize this into something usable. We've covered the inheritance channels, the neural mechanism, the worthiness gap, the reframing technique, and the exposure approach. What are the three things someone walks away with?
First, identify the inheritance. Write down three money messages you received before 18. Whose voice is it? Is it helping or hurting? That alone is diagnostic. Just seeing it on paper changes your relationship to it.
Second, separate worth from transaction. Your rate is a market signal, not a moral judgment. Practice saying your number without a verbal apology. No, just, no, I was thinking maybe. No upward inflection at the end like it's a question.
Third, use the service frame. This rate allows me to bring my full capacity to this work without resentment. That's not a negotiation trick. It's an accurate description of why fair compensation matters, and it works.
If you're not ready for any of that, start smaller. Ask for a discount somewhere. Ask for something you don't even care about getting. Just practice the ask. Separate the ask from the outcome.
The ask is the skill. The outcome is just data.
Before we close, let me pose the question that's been sitting under this whole conversation. What would you do with the next 5 years if money shame were not a factor? That's not rhetorical. It's a diagnostic. If the answer is meaningfully different from what you're currently doing, that gap is the cost of the shame.
The cost compounds. Every year you don't negotiate, every invoice you undercharge, every rate you don't raise. It's not just that year's money. It's the base for every subsequent year. The $500,000 to $1.2 million figure isn't about one big negotiation. It's about hundreds of small moments where you either advocated for yourself or you didn't.
The encouraging thing, genuinely encouraging, not motivational poster encouraging, is that this is trainable. The 2024 clinical trial showed 41% reduction in shame scores in 8 weeks. That's not a personality transplant. That's a skill acquisition.
You don't have to become a different person. You just have to practice asking. Start small, escalate gradually, and let your nervous system learn what your intellect already knows. Asking doesn't kill you.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, on the island of Reunion, the larva of a particular scale insect, when crushed and mixed with citrus juice, produced a vibrant crimson dye that was used to color ceremonial textiles, making it one of the few documented cases of an insect-plant collaborative dye process in the Indian Ocean textile tradition.
An insect-plant collaborative dye process. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. We'll be back soon.
Until then, go ask for something.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.